Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
William Barr assigns U.S. Attorney John Durham to review the role of the FBI and U.S. intelligence agencies in the 2016 election. Good move or not? Plus, Alabama. The state of Alabama moves to pass a law that would effectively ban most abortions in the state in what some of the legislators say is a direct and intentional challenge to Roe v. Wade. What happens next there? Welcome. I'm Paul Gigot with the Wall Street Journal here with my colleagues, Kim Strassel. Hello, Kim.
Hello, Paul.
And Kyle Peterson. Hello, Kyle.
Hello, hello.
All right. So let's talk about John Durham, that assignment of a veteran prosecutor, a veteran with real experience in prosecuting law enforcement officials who go bad. He played a role in uncovering some of the FBI corruption in Boston related to Whitey Bulger, the mob boss who is now in prison. So he has experience with the FBI, and he would also been tagged by former Attorney General Mike Mukasey late in the Bush administration, the George W. administration, to look into the allegations that the CIA had illegally destroyed tapes of interrogation of terrorist suspects, and he brought no indictments in that case. But this is a formidable appointment, Kim, and a lot of people on the right are saying, great, lots of indictments coming. A lot of people on the left are saying, uh-oh, this is Bill Barr doing Donald Trump's bidding.
Well, first of all, that bio you just laid out is really important because it's rare in that, you know, prosecutors and FBI officials, they can be a little bit of a band of brothers. They don't tend to go after each other. As a result, there doesn't always tend to be a lot of accountability institutionally. And so Durham is an unusual breed that does seem to have the ability to step back and say, look, no, what are the rules here and were they followed? I think this is really important, too, because it's coming just as we know the Inspector General from the Department of Justice is going to put out his report looking at his piece of the Trump-Russia collusion investigation by the FBI and including the FISA warrant against Carter Page. And Durham's going to be able to pick up from that and potentially go farther because he'll have subpoena power. He has the ability to interview people outside of the Department of Justice. But on your point, you know, this is still early review stage, and I would say to those Republicans, they should really temper their expectations here because we don't know what's going to be found, and also we don't want to be locking people up just for doing their jobs.
Right. And but we, on the other hand, we do want particularly law enforcement agencies to be accountable if laws are abused. And one of the reasons for William Barr to do this is that Robert Mueller, the special counsel, did not look at this side of the story in his investigation. Instead, he looked at solely at the Trump-Russian collusion claims and essentially ignored some of the information about what the FBI had done, why it had started its counterintelligence probe, why it had gone and required a FISA warrant. He didn't, with Carter Page, he essentially accepted the word of the FBI that this was all normal business as usual. And what Durham can do is review that evidence, look at it and say, on the one hand, yep, that was all kosher, fine, no problems. And that'll be reassuring in its fashion if that's what he finds. On the other hand, he could say, you know what, this was really troubling, and here's what went wrong.
And the split reaction to the appointment, I think, shows the need for the appointment. I mean, as you said, there's the Democrats are saying there's nothing to see here. The Republicans are want heads on pikes, our editorial today said. And just think about what we're talking about here is surveillance of someone connected to a presidential campaign. That is a pretty serious charge. You know, the Attorney General Bill Barr used the word spying recently. The FBI director, Christopher Wray, Gray sort of distanced himself from that interpretation. And there's been dribs and drabs of information about this that have leaked out from various sources. There's been some reporting on it. But this provides the opportunity that the public will really get an answer and settle that questions. You know, was there spying essentially on a presidential campaign?
Kim, what does this mean, though, for the long crusade that one Kim Strassel has been on, and I've joined this, to make the documents related to the FBI role in 2016 and the FISA court warrant, the request, and the rest of it public, making those public? Is there a risk here that by putting Durham on this assignment that a lot of these documents are going to get buried forever?
I hope not. And I'm pretty sure that's not the intention. My sources said, remember that Bill Barr has been under pressure from Republicans to appoint a second special counsel to look into this. And he deliberately did not go down that route. And I think we should feel heartened by that decision. And it was undoubtedly driven by the fact that he knew that the same thing would happen as with Mueller, that it would create another black hole where nobody found out anything for years to come. So I think the goal here is for the IG to get out his report as a kind of building block, but then for Durham to proceed quickly. And we know that Barr is putting a priority on moving quickly, and that is entirely because he does want the true story to come out. So I'm very confident that at some point we're going to see a great deal of information, not just from the IG report, but from Durham's finding, and that will probably also include documents.
So for looking at it from a political matter, one thing to think about is we have the Mueller report now, mostly unredacted, which is one piece of the story, and there are other shoes still to drop. You know, in addition to Durham, there is a U.S. attorney in Utah, John Huber, who is looking into some of these things. There's the Justice Department Inspector General, who's going to have a report coming out shortly. As Kim indicated, President Trump's team, the White House, has suggested that they are perhaps going to declassify some of these documents. So the Mueller report, the splash has kind of already been made. As we move forward into 2020, there's going to be a lot of other information that's going to be coming out.
We heard last week from a very senior source of the White House that on the document front, he's deferring to the Attorney General, Kim. He's going to let Barr make a lot of those make those decisions. One of the other important aspects of this, though, for Durham, is that when Horowitz makes his report, and it'll be a public, the IG's report, Michael Horowitz, he could include criminal referrals. And because Horowitz doesn't have prosecutorial authority, Durham could take those referrals and then decide what to do with them.
There could be no doubt that there is going to be some criminal prosecutions, I think. Not only do we have confirmation from Barr that there are current multiple ongoing criminal investigations into leaks, which we obviously know happened. You go all the way back to the information that was leaked about former NSA National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. There was classified information that was part of that leak, and someone is probably going to go to jail for that. But we also know that Horowitz was taking a particular interest in leaks, and assuming that he traced some of these back, there may well be a referral or two in there for Durham. The question is whether or not he will make a case for any other violations of either internal policy or of statutes when it comes to the FBI's interactions with the FISA court, for instance, and other actions it took. So that, I think, is going to be more revealing. And some of these things are going to be a judgment call, too. You know, as I mentioned in the beginning, sometimes the work we give our officials wide latitude for a reason. And while Republicans are calling for people's heads on sticks, you know, sometimes the work they do, it may be abusive of power, but it may not violate a law.
Lindsey Graham, who's now the head of the Judiciary Committee in the Senate, has said that now with this assignment of Durham, he's now going to defer to Durham and Barr on this investigation and not go ahead, at least not at the present time, with the hearings that he had wanted on this. But that would have the Graham hearings would have provided a forum for airing some of these facts and testimony. I'm don't think I like that decision by Lindsey Graham. I mean, I think he could have conducted hearings that did interfere with Durham, Kyle.
Yeah, I agree with that. It's good to get as much of that stuff on C-SPAN for the public as you possibly can, which is not to say, though, again, that having Durham as a third party looking into this is not useful. I mean, we've heard from a lot of the principals who have been involved in these decisions. But again, it's just coming down to this bickering back and forth. I mean, in an op-ed a couple weeks ago, James Comey said that, you know, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein didn't have the character to stand up to Donald Trump. You know, Rod Rosenstein swiped back a couple days ago saying that Jim Comey has just turned into a partisan pundit. You can see how it would be really useful to have a third party who was not involved in any of the decisions at the time come in and take a look at this and measure it up against FBI policy.
On that debate, I'm with Rosenstein when it comes to Jim Comey. We're discussing the appointment of John Durham and also the new Alabama abortion law. And you're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. I'm Paul Gigot with Kyle Peterson and Kim Strassel. And we have an interesting story from the states, and that is Alabama legislature, House and Senate, Assembly and Senate have passed arguably the most restrictive abortion law in the United States in many, many a year. It would effectively criminalize the practice of performing an abortion by a doctor. And that would effectively ban abortions in the state. And some of the authors of this are forthright in saying this is a direct challenge and an intentional challenge to the Supreme Court on Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey, the two centerpieces of American abortion law now. And they want this to make its way all the way up to the Supreme Court and make the Supreme Court review their abortion jurisprudence, Kyle. One question is, will it ever make it to the Supreme Court? And the second question is, this a shrewd strategy by the anti-abortion movement to move this fast and challenge the court to do this?
Well, I think it will inevitably make it to the court in some form. The question is how long and what the venue is. You know, the Supreme Court gets to choose the cases that it takes, and it may decide that this is not the one that it wants to, put down the ruling on. As far as whether this is politically shrewd, I guess I would say no, because there are other cases that are pending that could have the same effect. Kentucky and Mississippi had bills signed recently protecting fetal life when the heartbeat can be detected. And so those bills, you would think, percolating through the courts would have a similar sort of constitutional issue with them. So when they get to the Supreme Court, the court could make the same determination as it would with this Alabama law. So in that sense, I'm not sure the Alabama law is all that helpful. But from a conservative standpoint, I think the way to think about this is the public, I think, has some muddied views about abortion. On one hand, there is pretty strong opposition to late-term abortion. On the other hand, the American public seems pretty comfortable with in vitro fertilization, which generally involves some leftover embryos that are often discarded. And so the conservative argument has always been who gets to decide where that line is drawn. And under Roe v. Wade, under Planned Parenthood v. Casey, it's judge-made law, essentially. I mean, nine people in the Supreme Court get to decide what constitutes an undue burden on a woman's right to an abortion. And the people in these states are essentially saying that that should be an issue that is open for political debate.
Kim, on the question of whether or not this particular law in Alabama makes it to the Supreme Court, I think there's almost there's very little chance. And here's why I say that. Under the operative judicial principle at play here in judging whether state laws are too restrictive on abortion rights is the Casey standard of the undue burden test. There is no way, no way that if you look at read that undue burden test, that this law passes muster. Zero. So I don't see, I mean, you could find a federal judge who might approve it. I doubt they will. So let's say a federal district judge overturns this state law, if the governor signs it, then it goes to the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals. The 11th Circuit Court of Appeals is going to side with the district court. So then the question becomes, does the Supreme Court hear any appeal from the state of Alabama? And I suppose they could. They need four votes to do that. But that means they need the votes of not just Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Neil Gorsuch. We don't know how other than Clarence Thomas, I think, would take it. But we don't know what the others would do. Would Chief Justice John Roberts and Brett Kavanaugh want to take a case that so that basically forces the conservatives with a narrow majority of 5-4 to overturn Roe v. Wade and Casey? My view would be, no, they won't take it.
Yeah, bingo. I agree. If there has been anything that has defined the Supreme Court just in the past year and since the very torturous fight over Brett Kavanaugh and his ascension there, it's been its unwillingness to go wading too deeply into controversial subjects. It just doesn't want to go there. I think John Roberts wants the court to settle some, who wants to get past some of this rancorous debate. And so I agree with you, Timmy. I see zero prospects of that happening. And it's why I don't think that this was a particularly shrewd strategy. I mean, there can be no question if you look across the states and the sudden sort of flurry to pass these new laws that they're all being designed in a way to set up a review one fashion or another at the Supreme Court and get a change in this policy. But I think you're much more likely to see that come from one of the laws that has been passed in Georgia, Kentucky, Mississippi, Ohio, that goes to the fetal heartbeat question, that has exceptions, for instance, for rape or incest, because they're more likely to potentially pass that Casey standard you laid out.
So if I could ask you, Paul, we've talked about these fetal heartbeat issues that are narrower. Do you think that there is potentially four justices when that percolates its way up to the Supreme Court to take that case?
I haven't looked at the heartbeat bills really closely, so it depends on what the restrictions are. We know that restrictions on process are, for example, limits, requirements on the registration of abortion providers, for example. Some of those have been able to pass muster. Education of women when they go into the requirements that women should hear. This is what happens in an abortion procedure. That is something that I think the court would there'd be five votes to allow for that. But boy, when you start restricting first trimester abortions in any law, then that's going to be a really difficult question for this court. And I think from the point of view of Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Kavanaugh, my guess would be they want to take this in incremental fashion. They don't want to look as if, oh boy, we suddenly got five votes that are appointed by Republican presidents, and now we're going to overturn presidents willy-nilly. Because let's face it, Roe v. Wade, I believe, was wrongly decided at the time. Casey, I believe, was wrongly decided at the time. But you now have decades of practice, decades of reliance by all kinds of people on that law and expectations about the law. I would, as a matter of just pure law, I would like to see Roe v. Wade overturned. On the other hand, if that happened, I believe that you would see, the abortion rights would be protected immediately in most states. Okay, they would pass and they would still exist. On the other hand, you'd have a brawl, political brawl for the ages that I don't think would do very well for the conservative, for conservatives who I think would lose that debate in most jurisdictions. So And it's also a question of the Supreme Court's credibility here. When you get a 5-vote majority suddenly, do you go around and look for every precedent you can overturn? I don't think John Roberts wants to do that.
There also may be a question of what is in front of that in the docket. So there is a Louisiana law that would require doctors to have admitting privileges at a hospital 30 miles from within where the abortion is going to be performed. And that is already sort of percolating in the courts and getting to the Supreme Court. So it's possible, too, that the Supreme Court will put down a ruling on that that allows more restrictions and then decline to hear some of these other cases.
Yeah, I think the test for this court for a time, and I could be wrong about this, but I think the test for Kavanaugh and Roberts, maybe Gorsuch as well, will be, is this a regulation something that we can judge according to the undue burden test as opposed to require us to overturn it?
Okay. Yeah, I would wager that at some point, and I don't think it's going to be anytime soon. Okay, I agree with Kyle that I think they may take around the edges sorts of cases. But at some point when this big question finally gets raised at the court, I would wager it'll be along something more like Arkansas's law, which, you know, they recently, they had it at 20 weeks. They moved it to 18. It's going to be around the viability question more than some of these more extreme test cases.
All right. You got another point, Carl?
Oh, I was just going to say, but that again just shows the difficulty of having judge-made law on this kind of stuff because, you know, undue burden and viability has changed and been pushed back over the years and will again as technology, as medical science advances.
Well, no question. Much better for the health of the politics of the country, in my view. If this had been left to the states, I think abortion rights would be in place nearly in the vast majority of states in the country. But that was taken away in Roe v. Wade, and we've been living under that regime ever since. And the question now is, with that regime in place for so long, what do the courts do? All right. Thank you, Kim. Thank you, Kyle. And we'll be back later in the week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.